Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to New Books in Film on the New Books Network. I am your host, Joel Cherney. Today, I will be speaking with Anthony Slide about his book, Magnificent Obsession, The Outrageous History of Film Buffs, Collectors, Scholars, and Fanatics, published in 2018 by the University Press of Mississippi. We likely all know people who are extreme fans of celebrities and movies, but Anthony's book tells the story of how the hobby began, as well as the people who spent their entire lives trying to compile their collections. Welcome, Anthony Slide.
Thank you for inviting me.
Well, we are talking about the book Magnificent Obsession, The Outrageous History of Film Buffs, Collectors, Scholars, and Fanatics. Obviously, the name says quite a bit, but what I found interesting is that you, when you talk about film buffs, you've got a specific group in mind, and as we talk, hopefully we can describe that group in a lot of detail so that the possible listeners, so they can decide, they get a better understanding of what you write about. But sure. Before we do that, I always like to get a little bit of background of the people I talk to, what kind of writing have you done in the past? What led you to be where you are in your career?
Okay, well, I go back quite a long way because I'm pretty old. I started, I guess, having a professional involvement with film back in the late 1960s. I worked for an annual called the International Film Guide in London, and I also founded a quarterly periodical called The Silent Picture, devoted, as the title suggests, to silent film. I published my first book, Early American Cinema, back in 1970. Since then, I've written a lot of other books, certainly 70 or more, and I've also edited more than 150 books. I used to edit the Filmmakers series for the Scarecrow Press. It's no longer published, and that ran to 126 volumes. And also, I've also sort of, in order to make some money, because you don't make money from writing books, I've also served as associate archivist of the American Film Institute and the resident film historian of the Academy of Motion Picture Arts and Sciences.
So you've been in California for a long time.
I came to California initially in 1971. I had a scholarship with the American Film Institute, and then I worked for the AFI back in Washington, D.C., until 1975, then I came back to Los Angeles, where I've been ever since, and in 1975, I started working for the Motion Picture Academy.
Obviously, you're from the United Kingdom, I'm assuming, by your accent.
I was born in Birmingham, England.
I used to live in Birmingham, Alabama, but I don't think it's the same.
No, the accent's different.
So, okay. As we say, this book, Magnificent Obsession, boy, I got to slow down when I try to say that so I do it correctly. Right at the beginning, you've got not even an introduction. You've labeled it warning. And one of the things you say in that initial point is that certain people aren't going to be happy with this book because of the – including some of the people who would be considered subjects. But one of the things I found interesting in that initial thing is you said that the academics might not like this book because much of the information is not well documented, and you don't have texts to, you know, you don't have sources that you can use that would be considered academic. But yet, you were the book is being published by the University Press of Mississippi. So I'd love to know what led you to this publisher. Have you written for them before?
Yes, I have indeed. I mean, I can't remember how many books I've published through Mississippi. I've written what I would like to describe as definitive books on the history of the Fan magazine, on the history of Hollywood extras. Mississippi also reprinted my Encyclopedia of Vaudeville. About a year or so ago, they published She Could Be Chaplin, which was the first biography of a silent comedian named Alice Howell, who is interesting because her son-in-law was George Stevens, the director, and so her grandson is George Stevens Jr., who founded the AFI and the Kennedy Center Honors. So I have quite an involvement with Mississippi.
Well, that's good, because as I say, one of the things I've noticed in doing these podcasts, and I do interview people from more popular publishers, but also a lot of academic publishers, and it's great some of the material that the academic publishers are coming out with that years and years ago, obviously, even if they were in existence, they wouldn't be necessarily considering for publication. And
well, I think you have to bear in mind there are some academic university presses like Mississippi and Kentucky who are also trade publishers. So they're selling their books through bookstores rather like, say, a quote, legitimate publisher. Whereas some university presses, like the University of California Press, sells only through Amazon.com and directly. It doesn't offer the books through Barnes & Noble or whoever.
Right. Well, and I have I've interviewed people from the University of Kentucky Press as well, which is great. So obviously from the title and the background is that we're talking about film buffs. But let's talk a little bit as we start. What led you to decide that this was a group of people that you wanted to write about?
Well, I've always tried to write about subjects that no one else has covered. I mean, I think in my entire career, for example, I was the first person to write about silent women film directors back in the 1970s. I was the first person to rediscover Alice Guy Blaché, the first woman filmmaker. I'm the first person to write, you know, on many, many different subjects relating to cinema. So I'm always looking for something new. And I'd always thought about a volume on film buffs. I wasn't quite certain how I could handle it. I was also concerned about libel laws, what I could say. So I thought, well, maybe I could write a book concentrating really on people who are no longer with us and also noting the difference between the old-time film buffs, the buffs of the 20th century, compared to the film buffs of the 21st century who rely on social media to get their message across.
Right, because even in that, like I say, that's another group you specifically state would probably not be happy with this book because it doesn't describe them. There is obviously still film, there are still film buffs, but you're talking about a group that didn't, you know,
well,
even
no longer exists, really.
Right, and even pre-internet.
Sure. Yeah, no, I mean, it does bother me in a way that people today don't understand what it was like back then to write about film, how hard it was. We didn't have Turner Classic Movies, we didn't have DVDs, we didn't have internet access to all types of information. We had to go to a library and we had to research, we had to read early trade papers, early fan magazines that were not indexed. There was no keyword search. If we wanted to see a film, we had to go to a film archive and view it. We couldn't sort of order it up on the internet or whatever. So it was a very different time. And there were a lot of people back then who worked very hard and who were very good and who are totally forgotten today simply because their work has been superseded by others. I would actually mention one of the people in the book, DeWitt Bodine, who I would call a film buff. He had actually been a screenwriter who wrote Cat People, Curse of the Cat People, many other films for Val Lewton. In old age, he couldn't get work as a writer and screenwriter anymore. So he thought maybe he could write career articles for Films and Review magazine, and people would get to know his name again. So So he started writing career articles, which were very good in their day, very well researched. But now, of course, you can go to IMDb and find most of the information he included in those articles. So he's forgotten, and that to me is unfair.
Yeah, even in your introduction, you talk about a number of people in your introduction just by names, and some of them obviously made it into the digital age because there's at least one person, I forget his name off the top of my head, who was well known at IMDb.com for some of the information he provided and how
which was fake.
Right, he wasn't always appreciated.
Well, quite frankly, I mean, not to criticize the IMDb, which is very useful, but you read reviews on the IMDb, and it's very obvious that whoever wrote the review hasn't seen the film, and this doesn't seem to bother anybody. And that, to me, is deeply disturbing to me.
And there's interesting these.
I'm deeply disturbed very easily, I guess.
Well, crowdsourced movie reviews, you've got to wonder sometimes. In fact, there was an article I read today that just came in the news, and this is October 4th that we're recording it. Supposedly, Rotten Tomatoes, which is one of the crowdsourcing movie databases, review databases, seems to have found that it had Russian trolls putting negative reviews of movies. So once again, we see the possible issues related to social media.
Yes. I mean, I don't know if this is sort of relevant or not, but actually last week I was interviewed by Alt Film Guide, which is an internet site, and they had sent me questions and I had sent them answers, and they were actually putting it up on their site, and they suddenly... The interview was gone. It disappeared. And then they went to their inbox and they found that my emails had also gone. So they called me and said, can you send us the emails again? And I said, sure. And I went to my inbox and they were gone from my inbox as well. So it was like there was a troll out there, maybe a sort of crazed film buff. It got into the system and deleted every reference to the interview. It was quite amazing. So it does happen.
Right. So when we talk about, like we've said already, that the film buffs we're talking about are folks that were interested in older movies, the movies in the past that, as you've pointed out, were much more difficult to, you know, to follow and to study wasn't the easiest thing in the world to do. In fact, it was almost impossible unless you were willing to spend a good part of your free time, however much that might be, in order to really... take advantage of being that kind of a film buff. Can you give me a typical example of a film buff that we're talking about here? What kind of things might they have been doing as far as to support their desire to follow film?
Well, obviously a film buff has to make a living, and so that. But they're probably going to work at a fairly menial occupation. You do find some film buffs are so desperate to be associated with the film industry that they'll go and work, say, for Universal, but in the mailroom or in the film shipping department or whatever, because that gives them a link to film somehow and makes them feel they're part of the studio system or whatever. Most film buffs, it's a hobby, and they're going to spend all their spare time on it. Many of them created their own little film societies where they'd have a 16mm projector. They'd rent or borrow 16mm prints of classic films, and they'd show them at home to friends. This is fairly routine, particularly in New York. They would go to libraries such as the New York Public Library, Lincoln Center, or the Academy of Motion Picture Arts and Sciences, Margaret Herrick Library in Beverly Hills, and they'd spend all their available time doing research. And of course, it was hard for them because they were working during the day and generally the libraries were not open at night. So it wasn't that easy to be a film buff back then.
And did they, from your experience in researching the film buffs, you had some, I would assume, that followed specific actors and actresses and that they would tend to focus their attention that way?
Yes, that's true. I mean... And I might add, it's generally limited to members of the acting profession. Somebody asked me, are film buffs interested in behind-the-camera talent? And I would say no. I think the only exception would be director D.W. Griffith. There were a number of film buffs who were totally obsessive about D.W. Griffith. In fact, somebody once observed to me that there must be something about Griffith that makes people crazy. All of these people who write about Griffith, quite frankly, are insane. And they know I've told them they're this, and they're quite happy to accept that label. I'm sorry, I've forgotten your question.
Oh, I was talking about the 10 most people, the film buffs were often are following specific actors and actresses.
Oh, yes, yes. Yes and no. I mean, you find, I don't know why it is certain actresses seem to appeal, say, to gay film buffs. Kay Francis for some of these, and she seems to have a lot of gay appeal. If they're interested in silent films, they're probably more interested in somebody like Gloria Swanson, who is glamorous, or Pola Negri, rather than, say, somebody who is more ethereal and perhaps a better actress like Lillian Gish. But then there are many film buffs who are interested in all films, so long as they're old, and also all films that are obscure. The more obscure they are, the harder they are to see, the more exciting it is to suddenly have access to one of them.
You talk about that quite a bit, is that the some films are even – the reason they're still known at all, if they're known, is because of some of the thing, some of the activities of a film buff who did everything they could to continue to keep that film known. And of course, as you say, nowadays, that's pretty easy to do, even with some older films that are now available for viewing from home. But some of these other folks, that was the only way that they could keep the information out there.
Yeah. I mean, particularly people in New York were lucky because William K. Everson, who might be called the dean of film buffs, although he really is a film historian, he was a Britisher who lived in New York from the 1950s onwards, and he ran what was called the Theodore Huff Memorial Film Society, at which, on a weekly basis, he screened very rare films from a huge 16mm film collection that he owned. And he didn't show popular classic films, he showed obscure films. He specialized in obscure films. He thought those were important to introduce to audiences. And so film buffs in New York would always gather at the Theodore Huff Memorial Film Society. They might also be found, of course, at the Museum of Modern Art, which had had daily filmings in its auditorium. And as I mentioned in the book, the buffs at the Museum of Modern Art had their designated seats, and God help anybody who sat in a seat that belonged to a film buff. And you would have the same number of film buffs sitting in the front row for every performance.
So obviously, we know from the history of film that it started off very slowly, or you know, lightly. It wasn't meant to be anything more than brief entertainment. Mm-hmm. And then over time, as the film industry began to grow, it became, as I just used the word industry, a true industry where it became a normal part of life almost for the average moviegoer, you know, especially going into silent into the early talking movies.
I mean, back say in the 20s, 30s, and 40s, people went to the movies on a weekly basis. The movie theaters in a specific town would show certain studios movies. You'd have Paramount movies showing at one theater, MGM movies showing at another theater. And it was a sort of ritual. The entire family would go to the movie. And then the next day, you know, if people were working in an office, they might gather around the coffee machine and sort of just talk about the movie they'd seen last night. It was an integral part of life, really.
And it really wasn't just a movie. It was a full. It was an evening. It was meant to include more than just a single movie muffin.
Usually you get a double feature. You get a newsreel. You get a short subject and a cartoon.
So when do we first? Can we identify when the first film buffs started to appear?
Well, it's very hard to identify simply because, of course, film buffs tend to be anonymous. But I did discover one sort of teenage boy in the early 1910s who would keep a record of every film he saw. It would indicate where he saw it, who the star was, the studio that made it. And that's really sort of something that film buffs routinely do, keep lists. Mm-hmm. So he was the earliest person we know, and I'm sorry I can't remember his name offhand, who kept a list of what films he saw.
Yeah, because as you point out, I mean, one of the things that I see in your descriptions is having a record of some sort is incredibly important. It's not just a matter of saying you've seen a lot of films. Being able to show your interest in a variety of ways, whether it's lists or other things like that.
It's a matter of ticking off a film. I've seen it, so I never need to see it again. And the more films you can tick off, the better a film buff you are. And of course, I guess film buffs hope one day they'll see all films, which will never happen. I'm sure that would be their desire.
You do mention that about not only do they keep track of how many films they've seen, but the one example you gave is somebody who also kept track of how much it cost him to see all the films. So
yes, I mean, and you've even got there was a German documentary made a few years ago about film buffs, and they had one woman there who kept the ticket stub for each film she saw, and the ticket stub had to be ripped by the attendant a certain way. It had to be, she wanted exactly half of the ticket stub, and she would have hysterics if the ticket stub was damaged in some way.
So
I mean, that is a typical film buff.
So I think the word obsessive probably appears obsessive, in just about any film buff description.
Yes.
Now, obviously, the initial film buffs, that's obviously what they had to, you know, what they built around. But then we start to see some other examples, and that's where they want to actually interact with the film stars, the concept of clubs and mail. And obviously, as you pointed out in the book, this is not always necessarily as appreciated by the actual actors and other people that were in contact with these folks.
No, I mean, starting in the 1920s and really reaching its zenith in the 1930s, you have fan clubs established. And the studios like to keep control of these fan clubs because they like to know how much fan mail a star might get. The more fan mail a star got, the more the studio would think, wow, that star's worth more money, that star's bigger than another star. So it was important to keep a record, really. At the same time, you know, there's a sort of line between film buffs and fans, because fans are not quite as obsessive as film buffs. It's hard to differentiate, and I have problems with it. But you do find that the fans really are desperate to meet their idols in some way, and studios used to keep stars well away from the public because it would destroy the image. If you have somebody promoted as a major glamorous star, you don't want them to be seen drinking in a coffee shop where any fan could come up to them. They must be isolated from the fans in some way. I mean, I tell the story in the book. There was one man who had seen an early Sylvia Sidney film back in, I think, in the 1960s. And he happened to see Sylvia Sidney. She came into a shop where he worked, and he told her that he had seen her film last night, and she looked at him and said, "You're fucking mad." And I'm sure her response was probably similar to many other stars, current or past, having the same meeting or whatever.
Yeah, Sylvia Sidney's an interesting example because she...
Well, Sylvia Sidney really hated me. I have seen Sylvia Sidney in action, and she certainly could be very volatile and very vitriolic if she wanted to be.
And interestingly, is one of the people you can point back from old years and years ago into more modern times. I mean, she acted quite late into her career, so that
yes, and I imagine, like many stars, she really needed to keep working. She needed the money. Nothing wrong with
that. I'm sorry.
I just said nothing wrong with that.
Anyway. Right. And then you do talk about another step or another stage that's important, and you mentioned it briefly before, is the idea of being able to actually see the films. Like I say, nowadays, I don't think anybody who's under maybe 50 would understand the concept. Anybody under 50 probably doesn't understand the concept that seeing these films, especially the more obscure ones, was almost virtually impossible unless you did something yourself to find it, or as you pointed out before, borrow it, or in some way, shape, or form, get the film.
Yeah, I mean, films, obviously, old films were not shown on television on a regular basis. There was no turn of classic movies. So the only way really to see an old film was to acquire a 16mm print of it. There was no DVD, there were no DVDs, no VHS tapes back then. So there were publications in which film buffs could buy and sell 16mm prints of old films. And you would have collectors, sometimes with huge hundreds, thousands of 16mm prints, and they would have screenings in their homes. They would set up a 16mm projector. They would invite friends to see it. If you were working, say, on a book project, you would ask around, is there a collector who has a print of this? I'm desperate to see it. And if they did, if you were lucky, they might invite you over to see it one evening. And that's the only way you could really see films, unless you went to a film archive. But film archives are only a limited number. George Eastman House in Rochester, New York, Museum of Modern Art in New York, Library of Congress in Washington, D.C., and UCLA Film and Television Archive here in Los Angeles. And also, you might have issues that some of these archives, actually, Museum of Modern Art, I don't know if they do today, but they used to charge money to see films from their collection. So it could be quite an expensive proposition.
So as we've seen, as we've been talking about, we've got people who just wanted to see as many movies as possible and wanted to be able to say and keep track of the movies they saw, and then the people who wanted to begin to interact, so to speak. When does the film buff become – when does collecting become important to a film buff, and what kind of material would they likely want to collect?
I think film buffs always tend to like visual material, so they want – lobby cards, posters, still photographs. They're not really interested in early documents. To me, as a film historian, I'd much rather see a document or a letter with great content. I don't really care about a lobby card. But film buffs want lobby cards. They want to collect the lobby cards. They want to frame them, put them on the wall. That's what they want. And you could offer somebody, say, a lobby card of D.W. Griffith's The Birth of a Nation, or for the same price you could offer a collector a signed letter from D.W. Griffith. They'd rather have the lobby card.
Well, would they like a lobby card signed by D.W. Griffith?
Well, that would be very desirable, yes. Yeah.
Right.
But that's not likely to happen.
True. But then the other things is we start to see our publications, magazines that are specifically devoted. I'm assuming there were such publications, that were out there sort of on a popular level, but the film industry ends up creating a publishing industry all by itself just for film.
Well, you have the fan magazines, of course, but, as the title suggests, they're for fans rather than buffs. And it's interesting, of course, that as the film buffs are not interested in current fan magazines. They want old fan magazines. So you'll have a film buff in the 1960s. He doesn't want a film buff. He doesn't want a fan magazine published in the 1960s. He wants the 1930s version of that fan magazine because it deals with the films and the stars that he's interested in. And then, of course, you get a publication, Films We Review, which began in 1950. It was a monthly publication. And it was a very interesting periodical because it catered both to film buffs and to what I would call film scholars. Certainly in the first 10 years of Films We Review, it has some articles by major, major directors. People like Carl Theodore Dreyer, King Vidor, whoever, writing articles about their work. And then it became a magazine with career articles. You would have essays on a person's career, followed by a very detailed filmography. And it was really, in the days prior to IMDb, this was the only way to find out the entire film record of an actor or actress. And also what really sort of labeled Films We Review as a Film Buff publication, it had a letter section, which was several pages long at the end. And here, the readers could write in, correcting what somebody had said, disagreeing with what another film buff had said, sort of promoting a particular star or a particular film. So in my opinion, Films and Review was the ultimate film buff publication.
Yeah, you even mentioned early in the book that to a film buff, the Holy Grail is being able to make a correction of an error that they found in print.
Yes. Film buffs love to cap. Believe me, I know as a writer, film buffs love to catch you out.
So, obviously then, and you mentioned it a couple places in the book, obviously regularly, is the issues of, you know, the whole issue of a film buff and libraries, where, and as somebody who is a librarian and worked in libraries for much of my career, including big libraries, the concept of people who decide that, who want to decide, okay, where is it better? Where is this particular item better? In a library where maybe no one will see it or no one cares about it, or with my collection?
I mean, that is very true. And it was a serious issue many years ago when libraries didn't really have much security. But particularly here in Los Angeles, the Motion Picture Academy Library, there was no search of materials or backpacks or whatever when you left the library. So film buffs were routinely stealing still photographs, clippings or whatever. Nowadays, of course, libraries tend to sort of be very security conscious, and you're practically strip searched before you're allowed to leave. And that, sadly, is the way it has to be. I have come across countless film buffs, quite frankly, who have proudly shown me material they have stolen, saying it's far better in my collection. I appreciate it more than that library, because that library just keeps it in a file folder and nobody sees it, or that's kept in a box on a shelf or whatever.
I worked at Cleveland Public Library, which is a very large library and with a pretty decent research section, although not specifically film related. And over the years, I know we had issues with that whole thing, not specifically, like I say, film related, but with other fans of other things, where, and not just fans, people who are obviously thinking of the financial aspect of it, of things.
Well, a lot of times, of course, you know, you do get people who say, I can't afford 25 cents to make a photocopy, so it's easier just to steal it. And beware of film buffs with razor blades. They'll be there razor blading out articles from fan magazines in a corner, unbeknownst to the librarian.
So, well, speaking of value, the kind of thing that a film buff is going for isn't necessarily, or is interested in, is not something that has a particular monetary value, right?
Well, no, I would disagree with that, because obviously these days lobby cards and posters have tremendous financial value. So yes, they are interested in material with monetary values.
But they're not necessarily interested in selling it to try to make money.
Oh, I see what you mean. No. I mean, once they own it, they definitely don't want to sell it. It's theirs, and it, till the day they die, they want it to be in their collection.
Yeah, you gave some examples of people who clearly overspent for things, but they wanted it so badly. And unfortunately, that is, I think, any fandom, depending on what it is, there are people who have that obsessiveness. We go back to word. That they have to have something.
You always find at auctions on eBay that there's two people want the same item, and it just becomes foolish and silly that neither is willing to give way. They're both determined to own something, and so they'll bid way beyond the value of that item. Desperation.
So, did some of the film buffs we've been talking about? Did they actually reach out to others? I mean, I know obviously you talked about the club. Was it more of a matter that they just wanted to have a club, and even if they were the only member, or were they actually trying to reach out to other people who might share their interest?
No, I think they did reach out to other people. I mean, one does get the impression that many film buffs were quite lonely people. And so really the only social interaction they had was gathering at, say, someone's house to see a 16mm film. Actually, a lot of people have pointed out to me that while my book is very funny, it's also very sad because these film buffs lead sad lives, really.
Yeah, in fact, you mentioned a few of them who
committed suicide, of course.
Right. That and you're absolutely right. I mean, it's just the concept of getting so obsessed or so that's their entire life, and when either there's a revelation of some sort or whether something happens that suddenly they lose whatever value that had, and then that's pretty unfortunate.
Well, people also tend to they set their idols up to worship, and they don't want someone to knock that idol down for any reason. And sometimes it can be quite silly. I mean, I remember some years ago, Raymond Burr, who played Perry Mason, everybody knew he was gay. It was no big deal. It certainly was no big deal for Raymond Burr. But this one woman wrote a book about him, and she refused to accept that her star was gay. How could he possibly be gay? And so she was sort of outraged when a book came out talking about his gay life. And that's ridiculous. I mean, you know, you accept people for who they are. You shouldn't have to worry about them in any way, shape, or form.
So obviously, many of the people you've researched or learned about lived their lives and their entire lives in pretty much in obscurity. Although, luckily, you were able to find out more about them, so not totally obscure. Are there specific people who you think are particularly interesting that you, and I know you write about them, so I'm not asking just as I wonder who it is, but people who you think are particularly well known or were particularly famous in some way for their work as film buffs?
Well, I think the people I would single out are the people who became professionals, who made a living in a way from being a film buff, although I don't like to label them as such. Now, Lennon Maltin is the perfect example. I've known Leonard since he and I were teenagers, and he has done very well for himself. He's a very intelligent man, very accessible. And he was a film buff, really, back when he was 14 years old. But he has built a career for himself as a writer, as a television personality, as the creator of the movie TV Guide. So, you know, he's the perfect example of a really good film buff who turned out well. William K. Edison, another example, he was the person who once said it takes 30 years for a film buff to become a film historian. I don't agree with that, but he might have called himself a film buff, but certainly in old age he was venerated as a major film historian and film scholar. So there are two examples.
The one person I wanted to ask specifically about, because I found he's the only one who got an entire chapter basically just about him, and that's Joe Franklin. Who was Joe Franklin?
Oh, you live in New York and you never heard of Joe Franklin? That's amazing.
I don't live in New York.
Okay, all right. Well, Joe Franklin.
I do actually know who he is, but okay. I wanted to...
Okay. Joe Franklin was a sort of... a New York phenomenon. He had his own radio show and his old television show where he was marketing nostalgia. And, I mean, the show was pretty awful. And that was why it was so appealing to people, because Joe really never seemed to know what he was talking about. But he also, and he had this huge collection of memorabilia. And he would just about have anybody on the show. It was like, I remember... his son once was talking to me and saying, "Tony, you should come on the show." And I said, "I don't want to." He said, "Come on, just give Dad a call. He'll have you on the show." And I thought, "I don't want to be on his show." But I think Joe, in a way, was an amazing guy because, yet again, he marketed nostalgia. He marketed himself as a film buff. And people liked him. I mean, there was nothing nasty or unpleasant about Joe Franklin. He was just fun.
So... later in the book, and this is something where I know, like we've been talking about, a lot of the kid, you know, the humor that you have in the book for good reason. But then there was some issues that I wanted to bring up, and that's the phrase that, unfortunately, it's a term we know way too much even nowadays, and that's the term of, you know, those are the stalkers. And that's where the obsessiveness, unfortunately, can get in the way. And I think one of the interesting things that comes out of the book is that stalkers weren't necessarily, it's not a modern thing. It is something that that has always been an issue, or long been an issue, even in older film industry people.
Yes, I mean, I mentioned Bebe Daniels, who was a victim of stalking about 1930, and she had to go to court to defend herself against this guy. Obviously, today stalkers are dangerous, largely because they tend to have guns, whereas at least at some of these, they didn't seem to walk around with guns back in the old days. They just simply made a nuisance of themselves. It's actually surprising. I was talking to a guy who used to work at Larry Emmons Bookstore in Hollywood. I didn't know this when I wrote the book, but Teresa Saldana used to come into the bookstore on occasion. She would actually buy still photographs of herself because she didn't have them. And she actually said, if this guy, David's name, ever comes into the store, he's stalking me, so please don't sell him any photographs of me. So I was sort of amazed with this. Anyway.
Yeah, but as I say, for all we talk about it now, of course, the other thing nowadays is that it's much easier for people to do their stalking because so much information's out there available about people. And so, it's one thing to be able to read a magazine to learn a little bit more about somebody, and then maybe try to do do an investigation to find somebody. Unfortunately, nowadays it's actually pretty easy to do if you really want to.
You know, addresses are relatively easily available on the internet. Quite frankly, back in the old days, the stalkers would generally hang out outside the studio gates, hoping to accost an actor or an actress when they came or went, but that you had studio guards who would protect the people and make certain they weren't approached or accosted in any way.
So in discussing, obviously you've, this group of people, as you've already pointed out, the reason why you're writing about them in some ways is because they haven't been written about before, and they are an interesting part of, secondary part of the film industry. Where do you feel like that the traditional film buff that we've been talking about, where does that period end? Where is the last of them?
Well, I use the cutoff basically as the end of the 20th century. But obviously, you do find the old star film buffs through into this century. And occasionally you'll meet an elderly person who is a genuine film buff, a genuinely nice person, who doesn't do social media. Usually if you really meet an old-time film buff, they don't have a computer, they don't have email. That really sort of labels them as a genuine film buff that I would admire. The film buffs I don't admire are the ones who have internet access.
Yeah, I can see how because that's where, like you've been talking, you mentioned it more than once in the book about wanting to avoid libel laws, because it can be interesting when you talk about somebody who they decide that they don't like the way you're talking about them, or they consider it to be insult or worse, libel.
Well, the problem is you can't. I don't do social media. I don't do Facebook or Twitter, but I have been shown postings about me on Facebook, which are not just offensive, but truly libelous. But what are you going to do about it? Nothing. Although, actually, in one particular instance, Facebook did take it down. I didn't ask them to, but somebody else did. I think it is an issue. You think of it as an issue affecting sort of major celebrities, and not non-entities like me, but it affects everybody, really.
Well, that's why there's been...
It can be hurtful. If you're a professional like me, it doesn't really matter, because you should be prepared for it. But if you're not a professional, if you're just an average man or woman, you don't want suddenly the hurt and pain of somebody posting something abusive about you on Facebook. This is a whole, modern issue, really.
Right. I think it is one of those things where... Unfortunately, social media, the 21st century social media has made it very easy. And there's a lot to be said for, when you can be virtually 100% anonymous and not looking at the person face to face, it's much easier to say pretty much anything you want. But
yeah. Yeah.
It's unfortunate, but I think one of the things that that your book shows is that its tendencies, where, you know, there are people who are like that. Some of them are harmless, and some of them not so much. But you give them the ability to reach out like that, and it makes things a little bit easier for them to act that way.
Absolutely.
Well, as I say, I always like interviewing authors when they, I've interviewed a lot of authors about individuals, whether they be directors or actors, specific movies, specific type of movies. But I think sometimes the most interesting books I like are the ones that give this kind of information about ancillary aspects related to the film industry and film, and that present a new way of looking at something that, especially with older film, that most people don't know about. So I really have to tell you how much I enjoyed your book, and that I hope people will reach out for it, because I think they will find a wealth of stories and also interesting information, and that they can learn more about this interesting group and fascinating group of people.
Well, thank you very much. I enjoyed writing and researching it. It was a matter for me of going back in time, pulling old journals out, looking at interviews I'd done, 30 or 40 years ago. So it was like an exploration for me.
Do you have any other writing projects going on right now?
Not really at the moment. I'm getting a little old, and find as I get old, I have problems remembering words. So, I'm sure most people have this issue, but so I'm sure something else will come along, and this is not the end of Anthony Slide. You'll be hearing from him again.
Okay. Well, thank you for joining me. I really enjoyed this conversation, and good luck with the book.
Well, thank you so much. I enjoyed it as well.
I hope you enjoyed the interview. Anthony's book adds important information about the so-called Golden Age of Hollywood. This is Joel Cherney, and we will be back soon with more New Books in Film on the New Books Network.